Death of an Expert Witness, Disc 7.
Dalgliesh went on to ask her about her movements on the previous evening. She said that she hadn't accompanied her brother to the concert, having a dislike of rustic junketing, no wish to hear the Mozart indifferently played, and a couple of drawings to complete. They'd had an early supper at about 6:45, and Howarth had left home at 7:30. She had continued working, uninterrupted either by a telephone call or a visitor, until her brother returned shortly after 10, when he had told her about his evening over a shared nightcap of hot whiskey. Both of them had then gone early to bed. She volunteered, without being asked, that her brother had seemed perfectly normal on his return, although both of them had been tired. He had attended a murder scene the night before and had lost some hours' sleep. She did occasionally make use of Mrs. Bidwell, for example, before and after a dinner party she and Howarth had given soon after their arrival, but certainly wouldn't call on her on a day when she was due at the lab. Dalgliesh asked, "Did your brother tell you that he left the concert for a time after the interval?" "He told me that he sat on a tombstone for about half an hour contemplating mortality. I imagine that at that stage of the proceedings he found the dead more entertaining than the living." Dalgliesh looked up at the immense curved wooden ceiling. He said, "This place must be expensive to keep warm in winter. How is it heated?" Again there was that swift elliptical flash of blue. "By gas central heating. There isn't an open fire. That's one of the things we miss. So we couldn't have burned Paul Middlemas's white coat. Actually, we'd have been fools to try. The most sensible plan would be to weigh it down with stones in the pockets and sling it into Leeming's sluice. You'd probably dredge it up in the end, but I don't see how that would help you to discover who put it there. That's what I would have done." "No, you wouldn't," said Dalgliesh mildly. "There weren't any pockets." She didn't offer to see them out, but Howarth was waiting for them at the foot of the stairs. Dalgliesh said, "You didn't tell me that your sister was Lorimer's mistress. Did you really convince yourself that it wasn't relevant?" "To his death? Why should it be? It may have been relevant to his life. I very much doubt whether it was to hers. And I'm not my sister's keeper. She's capable of speaking for herself, as you've probably discovered." He walked with them out to the car, punctilious as a host speeding on a couple of unwelcome guests. Dalgliesh said, his hand on the car door, "Does the number 1840 mean anything to you?" "In what context?" "Any you choose." Howarth said calmly, "Whewell published Philosophy of the Inductive Sciences. Tchaikovsky was born. Berlioz composed the Symphonie Funèbre Triomphale. I think that's the limit of my knowledge of an unremarkable year. Or if you want a different context, the ratio of the mass of the proton to the mass of the electron." Massingham called from the other side of the rover, "I thought that was 1836. Unless you're not fussy about rounding up. Good night, sir." As they turned out of the drive, Dalgliesh asked, "How do you come to remember that remarkably irrelevant piece of information?" "From school. We may have been disadvantaged when it came to social mix, but the teaching wasn't bad. It's a figure that sticks in the mind."
"Not in mine."
"What did you think of Mrs. Schofield?"
"I didn't expect her to be like that."
"As attractive, as talented, or as arrogant?"
"All three.
Her face reminds me of someone, an actress, French, I think."
"Simone Signoret when she was young?"
"I'm surprised that you're old enough to remember."
"I saw a revival last year of Casque d'Or."
Dalgliesh said, "She told us at least one small lie." Apart, thought Massingham, from the one major lie which she may or may not have told, he was experienced enough to know that it was that central lie, the affirmation of innocence, which was the most difficult to detect, and the small, ingenious fabrications, so often unnecessary, which in the end confused and betrayed. "Sir?" "About where she and Lorimer made love, in the back of his car." "I don't believe that. Do you?" It was rare for Dalgliesh to question a subordinate so directly. Massingham disconcertingly felt himself under test. He gave careful thought before replying. "Psychologically, it could be wrong. She's a fastidious, comfort-loving woman with a high opinion of her own dignity. And she must have watched the body of her husband being pulled from the wreckage of their car after that accident when she'd been driving. Somehow, I don't think she'd fancy sex in the back of anyone's car. Unless, of course, she's trying to exorcise the memory. It could be that." Dalgliesh smiled. "Actually, I was thinking on less esoteric lines. A scarlet Jaguar and the latest model is hardly the most inconspicuous vehicle for driving around the country with a lover. And old Mr. Lorimer said that his son hardly left home in the evenings or at night, unless to a murder scene. These are unpredictable. On the other hand, he was frequently late at the lab. Not all the lateness could have been work. I think that he and Mrs. Schofield had a rendezvous somewhere fairly close." "You think it important, sir?" "Important enough to cause her to lie. Why should she care if we know where they chose to disport themselves? I could understand it if she told us to mind our own business, but why bother to lie?" There was another moment, too, when very briefly she lost composure. It was when she talked about 17th-century church architecture. I got the impression that there was a small, almost undetectable moment of confusion when she realized that she'd stumbled into saying something indiscreet, or at least something she wished unsaid. "When the interviews are out of the way tomorrow, I think we'll take a look at the chapel at Hoggart's." "But Sergeant Reynolds had a look at it this morning, sir, after he'd searched the grounds. It's just a locked, empty chapel. He found nothing." "Probably because there's nothing to find. It's just a hunch. Now we'd better get back to Guy's Marsh for that press conference, and then I must have a word with the Chief Constable if he's back. After that, I'd like to see Brenda Pridmore again, and I want to call later at the old rectory for a word with Dr. Kerrison. But that can wait until we've seen what Mrs. Gotobed at the Moonraker can do about dinner." Chapter 6. 20 minutes later, in the kitchen at Leeming's, an incongruous compromise between a laboratory and rustic domesticity, Howarth was mixing sauce vinaigrette. The sickly, pungent smell of the olive oil, curving in a thin golden stream from the bottle, brought back, as always, memories of Italy and of his father, that dilettante collector of trivia, who had spent most of each year in Tuscany or Venice, and whose self-indulgent, hypochondriacal, solitary life had ended, appropriately enough since he affected to dread old age, on his 50th birthday. He had been less a stranger to his two motherless children than an enigma, seldom with them in person, always present mysteriously to their minds. Maxim recalled a memory of his dressing-gowned figure, patterned in mauve and gold, standing at the foot of his bed on that extraordinary night of muted voices, sudden running footsteps, inexplicable silences, in which his stepmother had died. He had been home from prep school for the holidays, 8 years old, ignored in the crisis of the illness, frightened and alone. He remembered clearly his father's thin, rather weary voice, already assuming the languors of grief. "Your stepmother died 10 minutes ago, Maxim. Evidently fate does not intend me to be a husband. I shall not again risk such grief. You, my boy, must look after your stepsister. I rely on you." And then a cold hand casually laid on his shoulder as if conferring a burden. He had accepted it, literally, at 8 years old, and had never laid it down. At first, the immensity of the trust had appalled him. He remembered how he'd lain there, terrified, staring into the darkness. "Look after your sister." Domenica was 3 months old. What ought he to feed her on? How dress her? What about his prep school? They wouldn't let him stay at home to look after his sister. He smiled wryly, remembering his relief at discovering next morning that her nurse was, after all, to remain. He recalled his first efforts to assume responsibility, resolutely seizing the pram handles and straining to push it up the broad walk, struggling to lift Domenica into her high chair. "Give over, Master Maxim, do. You're more of a hindrance than a help." But afterward, the nurse had begun to realize that he was becoming more of a help than a nuisance, that the child could safely be left with him while she and the only other servant pursued their own unsupervised devices. Most of his school days had been spent helping to look after Domenica. From Rome, Verona, Florence, and Venice, his father, through his solicitor, sent instructions about allowances and schools. It was he who helped buy the clothes, took her to school, comforted and advised. He had attempted to support her through the agonies and uncertainties of adolescence, even before he had outgrown his own. He had been her champion against the world. He smiled, remembering the telephone call to Cambridge from her boarding school, asking him to fetch her that very night, outside the hockey pavilion, gruesome torture house, at midnight. "I'll climb down the fire escape. Promise." And then their private code of defiance and allegiance. Contra mundum. Contra mundum. His father arrived from Italy, so little perturbed by the Reverend Mother's insistent summons that it was obvious that he had, in any case, been planning to return. "Your sister's departure was unnecessarily eccentric, Charlie. Midnight assignation, dramatic car drive across half England. Mother Superior seemed particularly pained that she had left her trunk behind, although I can appreciate that it would have been an encumbrance on the fire escape. And you must have been out of college all night. Your tutor can't have liked that." "I'm postgraduate now, Father. I took my degree 18 months ago." "Indeed. Time passes so quickly at my age. Physics, wasn't it? A curious choice." "Couldn't you have called for her after school in the orthodox way?" "We wanted to get as far away from the place as possible before they noticed she'd gone and started looking." "A reasonable strategy, so far as it goes." "Dom hates school, Father. She's utterly miserable there." "So was I at school, but it never occurred to me to expect otherwise. Reverend Mother seems a charming woman, a tendency to halitosis when under stress, but I shouldn't have thought that would have troubled your sister. They can hardly have come into intimate contact. She isn't prepared to have Domenica back, by the way." "Need Dom go anywhere, Father? She's nearly 15. She doesn't have to go to school, and she wants to be a painter." "I suppose she could stay at home until she's old enough for art college, if that's what you advise. But it's hardly worth opening the London house just for one. I shall return to Venice next week. I'm only here to consult Dr. Mavis Brown." "Perhaps she could go back to Italy with you for a month or so. She'd love to see the Accademia, and she ought to see Florence." "Oh, I don't think that would do, my boy. Quite out of the question. She'd much better take a room at Cambridge, and you can keep an eye on her. They have some quite agreeable pictures in the Fitzwilliam Museum." "Oh, dear, what a responsibility children are. It's quite wrong that I should be troubled like this in my state of health. Mavis Brown was insistent that I avoid anxiety." And now he lay, coffined in his final self-sufficiency, in that most beautiful of burial grounds, the British Cemetery at Rome. He would have liked that, thought Maxim, if he could have borne the thought of his death at all, as much as he would have resented the over-aggressive Italian driver whose ill-judged acceleration at the junction of the Via Vittoria and the Corso had placed him there. He heard his sister's steps on the stairs. So they've gone. 20 minutes ago, we had a brief valedictory skirmish. Was Dalgleish offensive? No more offensive than I to him. Honours even, I should have said. I don't think he liked me. I don't think he likes anyone much. But he's considered highly intelligent. Did you find him attractive? She answered the unspoken question. It would be like making love to a public hangman. She dipped her finger in the vinaigrette dressing. Too much vinegar. What have you been doing? Apart from cooking? No, thinking about father. Do you know, Dom, when I was 11, I became absolutely convinced that he'd murdered our mothers. Both of them? I mean yours and mine? What an odd idea. How could he have? Yours died of cancer and mine of pneumonia. He couldn't have fixed that. I know. It's just that he seemed such a natural widower. I thought at the time that he'd done it to stop them having any more babies. Well, it would do that all right. Were you wondering whether a tendency to murder is inherited? Not really. But so much is. Father's total inability to make relationships, for example. That incredible self-absorption. Do you know, he'd actually put me down for Stonyhurst before he remembered that it was your mother, not mine, who'd been R.C. A pity he did find out. I should like to have seen what the Jesuits made of you. The trouble with a religious education, if you're a pagan like me, is that you're left all your life feeling that you've lost something, not that it isn't there. She walked over to the table and stirred a bowl of mushrooms with her finger. I can make relationships. The trouble is that I get bored and they don't last. And I only seem to know one way to be kind. It's as well that we last, isn't it? You'll last for me until the day I die. Shall I change now, or do you want me to see to the wine? You'll last for me until the day I die. Contra mundum. It was too late now to sever that cord, even if he wanted to. He remembered Charles Schofield's gauze-cocooned head, the dying eyes still malicious behind two slits in the bandages, the swollen lips painfully moving. Congratulations, Giovanni. Remember me in your garden in Parma. What had been so astounding was not the lie itself, or that Schofield had believed it, or pretended to believe it, but that he'd hated his brother-in-law enough to die with that taunt on his lips. Or had he taken it for granted that a physicist, poor Philistine, wouldn't know his Jacobean dramatists? Even his wife, that indefatigable sexual sophisticate, had known better. I suppose you'd sleep together if Domenica happened to want it. A spot of incest wouldn't worry her. But you don't need to, do you? You don't need anything as normal as sex to be more to each other than you are. Neither of you wants anyone else. That's why I'm leaving. I'm getting out now, while there's still something left of me to get out. Max! What is it? Domenica's voice, sharpened with anxiety, recalled him to the present. His mind spun back through a kaleidoscope of spinning years, through superimposed, whirling images of childhood and youth, to that last unforgettable image, still perfectly in focus, patterned forever in his memory. Lorimer's dead fingers clawing at the floor of his laboratory. Lorimer's dull, half-open eye. Lorimer's blood. He said, "You get changed. I'll see to the wine." Chapter 7. What will people say? That's all you ever think of, Mum. What will people say? What's it matter what they say? I haven't done anything to be ashamed of. Of course not. If anyone says different, your dad'll soon put them right. But you know what tongues they have in this village. £1,000. I could hardly believe it when that solicitor rang. It's a tidy sum. and by the time Lily Pierce has passed the news around in the Stars and Plough, it'll be 10,000 more than likely. Who cares about Lily Pierce, silly old cow? Brenda, I won't have that language, and we have to live in this village. You may have to, I don't. And if that's the kind of minds they got, the sooner I move away, the better. Oh, Mum, don't look like that. He only wanted to help me. He wanted to be kind, and he probably did it on impulse. Not very considerate of him, though, was it? He might have talked it over with your dad or me. But he didn't know he was going to die.
Brenda and her mother were alone in the farmhouse, Arthur Pridmore having left after supper for the monthly meeting of the parochial church council. The washing up was finished, and the long evening stretched before them. Too restless to settle to the television, and too preoccupied with the extraordinary events of the day to take up a book, they sat in the firelight, edgy, half-excited and half-afraid, missing Arthur Pridmore's reassuring bulk in his high-backed chair. Then Mrs. Pridmore shook herself into normality and reached for her sewing basket.
Well, at least it will help towards a nice wedding. If you have to take it, better put it in the post office. Then it'll add interest, and be there when you want it. I want it now, for books and a microscope, like Dr. Lorimer intended. That's why he left it to me, and that's what I'm going to do with it. Besides, if people leave money for a special purpose, you can't use it for something else. And I don't want to. I'm going to ask Dad to put up a shelf and a workbench in my bedroom, and I'll start working for my science A-level straight away. He ought not to have thought of you. What about Angela Foley? She's had a terrible life, that girl. She never got a penny from her grandmother's will. And now this. That's not our concern, Mum. It was up to him. Maybe he might have left it to her if they hadn't rowed. How do you mean, rowed? When? Last week sometime. Tuesday it was, I think. It was just before I come home, and most of the staff had left. Inspector Blakelock sent me up to biology with a query on one of the court reports. They were together in Dr. Lorimer's room, and I heard them quarrelling. She was asking him for money, and he said he wouldn't give her any, and then he said something about changing his will.
You mean you stood there listening?
Well, I couldn't help it, could I? They were talking quite loudly. He was saying terrible things about Stella Mawson, you know, that writer Angela Foley lives with. I wasn't eavesdropping on purpose. I didn't want to hear. You could have gone away. And come up again all the way from the front hall. Anyway, I had to ask him about the report for the Munnings case. I couldn't go back and tell Inspector Blakelock that I hadn't got the answer because Dr. Lorimer was having a row with his cousin. Besides, we always listen to secrets at school. You're not at school now, really, Brenda. You worry me sometimes. One moment you behaved like a sensible adult, and the next anyone would think you were back in the fourth form. You're 18 now, an adult. What's school to do with it? I don't know why you're getting so het up. I didn't tell anyone. Well, you'll have to tell that detective from Scotland Yard. Mum, I can't. He hasn't got anything to do with the murder. Who's to say? You're supposed to tell the police anything that's important. Didn't he tell you that?
He had told her exactly that. Brenda remembered his look, her own guilty blush. He had known that she was keeping something back. She said with stubborn defiance,
"Well, I can't accuse Angela Foley of murder, or as good as accuse her anyway.
Besides," she proclaimed triumphantly, remembering something Inspector Blakelock had told her, "it would be hearsay, not proper evidence. And, Mum, there's another thing. Supposing she didn't really expect him to alter the will so soon. That solicitor told you that Dr. Lorimer made the new will last Friday, didn't he? Well, that was probably because he had to go to a scene of crime in Ely on Friday morning. The police call only came through at 10 o'clock. He must have gone to his solicitors then."
"What do you mean?"
"Nothing. Only if people think I had a motive, then so did she."
"Of course you didn't have a motive. That's ridiculous. It's wicked. Oh, Brenda, if only you'd come to the concert with Dad and me."
"No, thank you.
Miss Spencer singing Pale Hands I Loved, and the Sunday school kids doing their boring old maypole dance, and the WI with their handbells, and old Mr. Matthews bashing away with the acoustic spoons. I've seen it all before. But you'd have had an alibi. So I would if you and Dad had stayed here at home with me. It wouldn't have mattered where you'd been if it weren't for that £1,000. Well, let's hope Gerald Bolam understands. Well, if he doesn't, he knows what he can do. I don't see what he's got to do with Gerald. I'm not married to him, nor engaged for that matter. He'd better not interfere.
She looked across at her mother and was suddenly appalled. She had only seen her look like this once before, the night when she had had her second miscarriage, and had been told by old Dr. Green that there could never now be another baby. Brenda had been only 12 at the time, but her mother's face, suddenly remembered, had looked exactly as it did now, as if an obliterating hand had passed over it, wiping off brightness, blunting the contours of cheek and brow, dulling the eyes, leaving an amorphous mask of desolation. She remembered and understood what, before, she had only felt, the anger and resentment that her mother, indestructible and comforting as a great rock in a weary land, should herself be vulnerable to pain. She was there to soothe Brenda's miseries, not to suffer herself, to comfort, not to seek comfort. But now Brenda was older, and she was able to understand. She saw her mother clearly, like a stranger newly met. The cheap dress, spotlessly clean, as always, with the brooch Brenda had given her for her last birthday, pinned to the lapel. The ankles thickening above the sensible low-heeled shoes, the pudgy hands speckled with the brown stains of age, the wedding ring of dull gold biting into the flesh, the curly hair that had once been red gold like her own, still brushed plainly to one side and held in a tortoiseshell slide, the fresh, almost unlined skin. She put her arms around her mother's shoulders. "Oh, Mum, don't worry. It'll be all right. Commander Dalgleish will find out who did it, and then everything will be back to normal. Look, I'll make you some cocoa. Don't let's wait till Dad's back from the PCC. We'll have it now, Mum. It's all right. Really, it is. It's all right." Simultaneously, their ears caught the hum of the approaching car. They gazed at each other, speechless, guilty as conspirators. This wasn't their ancient Morris. And how could it be? The parochial church council never finished their business before 8:30. Brenda went to the window and peered out. The car stopped. She turned to her mother, white-faced. "It's the police. It's Commander Dalgleish." Without a word, Mrs. Pridmore got resolutely to her feet. She placed a hand briefly on her daughter's shoulder, then went out into the passage and opened the door before Massingham had lifted his hand to knock. She said through stiff lips, "Come in, please. I'm glad that you're here. Brenda has something to tell you, something that I think you ought to know." Chapter 8. The day was nearly over. Sitting in his dressing gown at the small table in front of the window in his bedroom at the Moonraker, Dalgleish heard the church clock strike 11:30. He liked his room. It was the larger of the two that Mrs. Gotobed had been able to offer. The single window looked out over the churchyard toward the village hall, and beyond it to the clear story and square flint tower of St. Nicholas's Church. There were only three rooms for guests at the inn. The smallest and noisiest, since it was over the public bar, had fallen to Massingham. The main guest room had already been taken by an American couple touring East Anglia, perhaps in search of family records. They had sat at their table in the dining parlour, happily occupied with maps and guidebooks, and if they had been told that their newly arrived fellow guests were police officers investigating a murder, they were too well bred to betray interest. After a brief smile and a good evening in their soft transatlantic voices, they had turned their attention again to Mrs. Gotobed's excellent casserole of hare in cider. It was very quiet. The muted voices from the bar had long since been silent. It was over an hour since he had heard the last shouted goodbyes. Massingham, he knew, had spent the evening in the public bar, hoping, presumably, to pick up scraps of useful information. Dalgleish hoped that the beer had been good. He had been born close enough to the Fens to know that, otherwise, Massingham would have found it a frustrating evening. He got up to stretch his legs and shoulders, looking round with approval at the room. The floorboards were of ancient oak, black and stout as ship's timbers. A fire of wood and turf burned in the iron Victorian grate, the pungent smoke curtsying under a decorated hood of wheat ears and flower posies tied with ribbons. The large double bed was of brass, high and ornate, with four great knobs, large as polished cannonballs, at the corners. Mrs. Gotobed had earlier folded back the cover to reveal a feather mattress shaken to an inviting plumpness. In any four-star hotel, he might have enjoyed greater luxury, but hardly such comfort. He returned to his work. It had been a crowded day of interrogation and renewed interrogation, telephone calls to London, a hurriedly arranged and unsatisfactory press conference, two consultations with the chief constable, the gathering of those odd-shaped pieces of information and conjecture which, in the end, would click together to form the completed picture. It might be a trite analogy, this comparison of detection with fitting together a jigsaw, but it was remarkably apt, not least because it was so often that tantalizing, elusive piece with the vital segment of a human face that made the picture complete. He turned the page to the last interview of the day with Henry Kerrison at the old rectory. The smell of the house was still in his nostrils, an evocative smell of stale cooking and furniture polish, reminding him of childhood visits with his parents to over-large, ill-heated country vicarages. Kerrison's housekeeper and children had long been in bed, and the house had held a melancholy, brooding silence, as if all the tragedies and disappointments of its numerous incumbents still hung in the air. Kerrison had answered the door himself, and had shown him and Massingham into his study, where he was occupied in sorting coloured slides of post-mortem injuries, to illustrate a lecture he was to give the following week to the Detection Training School. On the desk was a framed photograph of himself as a boy, with an older man, obviously his father. They were standing on a crag, climbing ropes slung around their shoulders. What interested Dalgleish as much as the photograph itself was the fact that Kerrison hadn't bothered to remove it. He hadn't appeared to resent his visitor's late arrival. It was possible to believe that he welcomed their company. He had worked on in the light of his desk lamp, fitting each slide into his viewer, then sorting it into the appropriate heap, intent as a schoolboy with a hobby. He had answered their questions quietly and precisely, but as if his mind were elsewhere. Dalgleish asked him whether his daughter had talked to him about the incident with Lorimer. "Yes, she did tell me. When I got home for lunch from my lecture, I found her crying in her room. It seems that Lorimer was unnecessarily harsh. But Nell is a sensitive child, and it's not always possible to know the precise truth of the matter." "You didn't talk to him about it?" "I didn't talk to anyone. I did wonder whether I ought to, but it would have meant questioning Inspector Blakelock and Miss Pridmore, and I didn't wish to involve them. They had to work with Lorimer. So, for that matter, did I. The effectiveness of an isolated institution like Hoggart's largely depends on good relationships among the staff. I thought it was best not to take the matter further. That may have been prudence, or it may have been cowardice. I don't know." He had smiled sadly and added, "I only know that it wasn't a motive for murder." A motive for murder. Dalgliesh had discovered enough motives in this first crowded but not very satisfactory day. But motive was the least important factor in a murder investigation. He would gladly have exchanged the psychological subtleties of motive for a single, solid, incontrovertible piece of physical evidence linking a suspect with the crime. And so far, there was none. He still awaited the report from the Metropolitan Laboratory on the mallet and the vomit. The mysterious figure seen by old Goddard fleeing from Hoggart's remained mysterious. No other person had yet been traced or had come forward to suggest that he wasn't a figment of the old man's imagination. The tyre marks near the gate, now definitely identified from the tyre index at the laboratory, still hadn't been linked to a car. Not surprisingly, no trace had been found of Middlemas's white coat, and no indication whether or how it had been disposed of. An examination of the village hall and the hobby horse costume had produced nothing to disprove Middlemas's account of his evening, and it was apparent that the horse, a heavy, all-enveloping contraption of canvas and serge, ensured that its wearer would be unidentifiable, even in Middlemas's case, to his elegant handmade shoes. The central mysteries of the case remained. Who was it who had telephoned the message to Lorimer about the can being burned and the number 1840? Was it the same woman who had rung Mrs. Bidwell? What had been written on the missing sheet from Lorimer's rough notebook? What had prompted Lorimer to make that extraordinary will? Lifting his head from the files, he listened. There was a noise, faintly discernible, like the creeping of myriad insects. He remembered it from his childhood nights, lying awake in the nursery of his father's Norfolk vicarage, a sound he had never heard in the noise of cities, the first gentle, sibilant whisper of the night rain. Soon it was followed by a spatter of drops against the window and the rising moan of the wind in the chimney. The fire spluttered and then flared into sudden brightness. There was a violent flurry of rain against the pane, and then, as quickly as it had begun, the brief storm was over. He opened the window to savour the smell of the damp night air, and gazed out into a blanket of darkness, black fen earth merging with the paler sky. As his eyes became accustomed to the night, he could discern the low rectangle of the village hall, and beyond it, the great medieval tower of the church. Then the moon sailed out from behind the clouds, and the churchyard became visible, the obelisks and gravestones gleaming pale as if they exuded their own mysterious light. Below him, faintly luminous, lay the gravel path along which, the previous night, the Morris dancers, bells jangling, had made their way through the rising mist. Staring out over the churchyard, he pictured the hobby horse pawing the ground to meet them, rearing its grotesque head among the gravestones, and snapping the air with its great jaws. And he wondered again who had been inside its skin. The door beneath his window opened, and Mrs. Gotobed appeared and crooned into the darkness, enticing in her cat. "Snowball, Snowball, good boy now." There was a flash of white, and the door was closed. Dalgliesh latched his window and decided that he, too, would call it a day.
Book 4. Hanged by the Neck. Chapter 1. Sprague's cottage, low-built and top-heavy under its low, occluding roof of thatch, wire-netted, strong against the fen winter gales, was almost invisible from the road. It lay about 3/4 of a mile northeast from the village, and was fronted by Sprague's Green, a wide, triangular grass verge planted with willows. Pushing open the white wicker gate, on which someone had optimistically but fruitlessly substituted the word lavender for Sprague's, Dalgliesh and Massingham stepped into a front garden as brightly ordered and conventional as that of a suburban villa. An acacia tree in the middle of the lawn flaunted its autumn glory of red and gold. The yellow climbing roses trained over the door still gleamed with a faint illusion of summer. And a massed bed of geraniums, fuchsia and dahlias, supported by stakes and carefully tended, flared in discordant glory against the bronze of the beech hedge. There was a hanging basket of pink geraniums beside the door, now past their best, but still bright with a few tattered blooms. The knocker was a highly polished brass fish, every scale gleaming. The door was opened by a slight, almost fragile woman, barefooted and wearing a cotton overblouse patterned in greens and brown above her corduroy slacks. She had coarse, dark hair, strongly streaked with grey, and worn in a short bob, with a heavy fringe that curved low to meet her eyebrows. Her eyes were her most remarkable feature, immense, the irises brown, speckled with green, translucently clear under the strongly curved brows. Her face was pale and taut, deeply etched with lines across the forehead and running from the widely springing nostrils to the corners of the mouth. It was a face, thought Dalgliesh, of a tortured masochist in a medieval triptych, the muscles bulging and knotted as if they had been racked. But no one coming under the gaze of those remarkable eyes could call it plain or ordinary. Dalgliesh said, "Miss Mawson, I'm Adam Dalgliesh. This is Inspector Massingham." She gave him a direct, impersonal gaze and said without smiling, "Come through into the study, will you? We don't light the sitting-room fire until the evening. If you want to speak to Angela, I'm afraid she's not here at present. She's over at Post Mill Cottage with Mrs. Swaffield, meeting the Social Security people. They're trying to persuade old Lorimer to go into an old people's home. Apparently he's being obstinately resistant to the blandishments of bureaucracy. Good luck to him." The front door opened directly into a sitting-room with a low oak-beamed ceiling. The room surprised him. To enter it was like walking into an antique shop, but one where the proprietor had arranged his oddly assorted wares with an eye to the general effect. The mantel-shelf and every ledge bore an ornament. Three hanging cupboards held a variety of mugs, teapots, painted jugs, and Staffordshire figures. And the walls were almost covered with prints, framed old maps, small oil paintings, and Victorian silhouettes in oval frames. Above the fireplace was the most spectacular object, a curved sword with a finely wrought scabbard. He wondered whether the room reflected merely an indiscriminate acquisitiveness, or whether these carefully disposed objects served as comforting talismans against the alien, undomesticated spirits of the encroaching fens. A wood fire was laid, but not lit, in the open hearth. Under the window, a polished, gate-legged table was already laid for two. Miss Mawson led the way through to her study. It was a smaller, less cluttered room at the back, with a latticed window giving a view of a stone terrace, a lawn with a sundial in the middle, and a wide field of sugar beet, still unharvested. He saw with interest that she wrote by hand. There was a typewriter, but it stood on a table by itself. The working desk under the window held only a pad of unlined paper, covered with a black upright holograph in an elegant italic. The lines were carefully patterned on the paper, and even the marginal alterations were aligned. Dalgliesh said, "I'm sorry if we are interrupting your work." "You aren't. Sit down, won't you both? It isn't going well this morning. If it were, I should have hung a don't disturb notice on the knocker, and you wouldn't have got in. Still, it's nearly finished. Only one chapter to do now. I suppose you want me to give Angela an alibi. Helping the police, isn't it called? What were we doing on Wednesday night, and when, and why, and where, and with whom? We would like to ask you some questions, certainly. But that one first, presumably. There's no difficulty. We spent the evening and night together from 6:15, which was the time she arrived home." "Doing what, Miss Mawson?" "What we normally do. We separated the day from the evening, me with whisky, Angela with sherry. I asked about her day, and she inquired about mine. Then she lit the fire and cooked the meal. We had avocado pear with sauce vinaigrette, chicken casserole and cheese and biscuits. We washed up together, and then Angela typed my manuscript for me until 9. At 9 we turned on the television and watched the news, followed by the play. That brought us to 10:45, cocoa for Angela, whiskey for me, and bed.
Neither of you left the cottage?
No.
Dalgleish asked how long she had lived in the village.
Me? 8 years. I was born in the Fens, at Soham, actually, and spent most of my childhood here. But I went up to London University when I was 18, took a second-class degree, and then worked, not particularly successfully, at various jobs in journalism and publishing. I came here 8 years ago when I heard that the cottage was to let. That's when I first decided to give up my job and become a full-time writer. And Miss Foley? She came to live here 2 years ago. I advertised locally for a part-time typist, and she replied. She was living in lodgings at Ely then, and wasn't particularly happy there, so I suggested that she move in. She had to depend on the bus to get to work. Living here is obviously much more convenient for the lab.
So you've lived long enough in the village to get to know people?
As much as one ever does in the Fens, but not well enough to point a finger at a murderer for you.
How well did you know Dr. Lorimer?
By sight. I wasn't told that Angela was his cousin until she came to live with me. They're not close, and he never came here. I've met most of the lab staff, of course. Dr. Howarth started a string quartet soon after he arrived, and last August they gave a concert in the Wren Chapel. Afterwards there was wine and cheese in the vestry. I met a number of the staff then. Actually, I already knew them by sight and name, as one does in a village. We use the same post office and the same pub. But if you're hoping for village and lab gossip, it's no use coming to me.
Dalgleish said, "Was the concert in the chapel successful?"
"Not particularly." "Howarth is a very fine amateur violinist, and Claire Easterbrook is a competent cellist, but the other two weren't up to much. He hasn't repeated the experiment." I gathered that there was a certain amount of unkind comment about a new arrival who saw it as his duty to civilize the underprivileged natives, and it may have got to his ears. He does rather give the impression that he sees himself as bridging single-handed the culture gap between the scientist and the artist. Or perhaps he wasn't satisfied with the acoustics. My own view is that the other three didn't want to go on playing with him. As a leader of a quartet, he probably behaved with much the same arrogance as he does as director. The lab is certainly more efficient. The work output is up 20%. Whether the staff are happy is another matter.
So she wasn't altogether immune to lab and village gossip, thought Dalgleish. He wondered why she was being so frank.
Equally frank, he asked bluntly,
"When you were at Postmill Cottage yesterday, did you go upstairs?"
"Fancy the old man telling you that. What did he think I was after, I wonder? I went up to the bathroom to see if there was a tin of scouring powder there to clean the sink. There wasn't."
"You know about Dr. Lorimer's will, of course."
"I imagine the whole village does. Actually, I was probably the first to know. The old man was getting agitated to know whether there was any money coming, so Angela rang the solicitor. She'd met him at the time her grandmother's will was read. He told her that the cottage was to go to the old man with £10,000, so she was able to put his mind at rest."
"And Miss Foley herself gets nothing?"
"That's right. And that new clerical officer at the lab, whom Edwin had apparently taken a fancy to, gets £1,000.
A not particularly just will."
"Have you ever known beneficiaries who thought a will was just?" "His grandmother's will was worse. Angela lost the money then, when it could have made a difference to her life. Now she doesn't need it. We manage perfectly well here."
"Presumably it wasn't a shock to her. Didn't he tell her of his intentions?"
"If that's meant to be a tactful way of finding out whether she had a motive for murder,
you can ask her yourself.
Here she is."
Angela Foley came through the sitting room, tugging off her headscarf. Her face darkened at the sight of the visitors, and she said with quick, defensive annoyance, "Miss Mawson likes to work in the mornings. You didn't say that you were coming." Her friend laughed. "They haven't worried me. I've been getting a useful insight into police methods. They're effective without being crude." "You're back early." "The social work department rang to say that they can't get over until after lunch. Uncle doesn't want to see them, but he wants to see me even less. He's having lunch with the Swaffields at the rectory, so I thought I might as well come home." Stella Mawson lit a cigarette. "You've arrived at an opportune time. Mr. Dalgleish was inquiring, tactfully, whether you had a motive for murdering your cousin. In other words, did Edwin tell you that he was about to alter his will?" Angela Foley looked at Dalgleish and said calmly, "No. He never discussed his affairs with me, and I didn't discuss mine with him. I don't think I've spoken to him during the last 2 years, except about lab business." Dalgleish said, "It's surprising, surely, that he should want to change a long-standing will without talking to you about it." She shrugged, and then explained, "It had nothing to do with me. He was only my cousin, not my brother. He transferred to Hoggart's from the Southern Laboratory 5 years ago to live with his father, not because I was here. He didn't really know me. If he had, I doubt whether he would have liked me. He owed me nothing, not even justice." "Did you like him?" She paused and thought, as if the question were one to which she herself wanted an answer. Stella Mawson, eyes narrowed, regarded her through the cigarette smoke. Then Miss Foley spoke. "No, I didn't like him. I think I was even a little afraid of him. He was like a man psychologically burdened, unsure of his place in life. Lately, the tension and unhappiness were almost palpable. I found it embarrassing and, well, somehow menacing. People who were really secure in their own personalities didn't seem to notice or be bothered by it, but the less secure felt threatened. I think that's why Clifford Bradley was so afraid of him." Stella Mawson said, "Bradley probably reminded Edwin of himself when he was young. He was painfully insecure, even in his job when he first started. Do you remember how he used to practice his evidence on the night before he went into the box? Writing down all the possible questions the opposing counsel might ask, making sure that he was word-perfect with the answers, learning all the scientific formulas by heart to impress the jury. He made a mess of one of his first cases and never forgave himself." There was a strange little silence. Angela Foley seemed about to speak, then changed her mind. Her enigmatic gaze was fixed on her friend. Stella Mawson's eyes shifted. She walked over to her desk and stubbed out her cigarette. She said, "Your aunt told you. She used to have to read out the questions for him over and over again, an evening of tension and incomprehensible boredom. Don't you remember?" "Yes," said Angela in her high, dispassionate voice. "Yes, I remember." She turned to Dalgleish. "If there's nothing else you want to ask me, there are things I need to get on with. Dr. Howarth isn't expecting me at the lab until this afternoon, and Stella will want to work." Both women showed them out, standing together in the doorway as if politely speeding departing guests. Dalgleish almost expected them to wave goodbye. He hadn't questioned Miss Foley about the quarrel with her cousin. The time might come for that, but it wasn't yet. It had interested, but not surprised him, that she had lied. But what had interested him more was Stella Mawson's story of Lorimer rehearsing his evidence on the night before a trial. Whoever had told her this, he was fairly certain that it hadn't been Angela Foley. As they drove away, Massingham said, £50,000 could change her whole life. Give her some independence, get her away from here. What sort of life is it for a young woman, just the two of them, stuck here in this isolated swamp? And she seems little more than a drudge.
Dalgliesh, unusually, was driving. Massingham glanced at the sombre eyes in the mirror. The long hands laid lightly on the wheel. Dalgliesh said, "I'm remembering what old George Greenall, the first detective sergeant I worked under, told me. He'd had 25 years in the CID. Nothing about people surprised him. Nothing shocked him. He said, "They'll tell you that the most destructive force in the world is hate. Don't you believe it, lad? It's love. And if you want to make a detective, you'd better learn to recognize it when you meet it."
Chapter 2. Brenda was over an hour late at the laboratory on Thursday morning. After the excitement of the previous day, she had overslept, and her mother had deliberately not called her. She had wanted to go without her breakfast, but Mrs. Pridmore had placed the usual plate of bacon and egg before her and had said firmly that Brenda wouldn't leave the house until it was eaten. Brenda, only too aware that both her parents would be happier if she never set foot in Hoggart's again, knew better than to argue. She arrived, breathless and apologetic, to find Inspector Blakelock trying to cope with 2 days' intake of exhibits, a steady stream of arrivals, and a constantly ringing telephone. She wondered how he would greet her, whether he had learned about the £1,000, and if so, whether it would make any difference. But he seemed his usual stolid self. He said, "As soon as you've taken off your things, you're to go to the director. He's in Miss Foley's office. The police are using his. Don't bother about making tea. Miss Foley will be out until after lunch. She has to see someone from the local authority social services about her uncle." Brenda was glad that she wouldn't have to face Angela Foley yet. Last night's admission to Commander Dalgliesh was too like betrayal to be comfortable. She said, "Everyone else is in, then?" "Clifford Bradley hasn't made it. His wife telephoned to say that he's not well. The police have been here since 8:30. They've been checking all the exhibits, especially the drugs, and they made another search of the whole lab. Apparently they got the idea that there's something odd going on." It was unusual for Inspector Blakelock to be so communicative. Brenda asked, "What do you mean, something odd?" "They didn't say. But now they want to see every file in the lab with the number 18 or 40 or 1840 in the registration." Brenda's eyes widened. "Do you mean for this year only? Or do we have to go back to those on microfilm?" "I've got out this year's and last year's to begin with, and Sergeant Underhill and the constable are working on them now. I don't know what they hope to find, and by the look of them, neither do they. Better look nippy. Dr. Howarth said that you were to go in to him as soon as you arrive." "But I can't do shorthand and typing. What do you think he wants me for?" "He didn't say. Mostly getting out files, I imagine. And I dare say there'll be a bit of telephoning and fetching and carrying." "Where's Commander Dalgliesh? Isn't he here?" "He and Inspector Massingham left about 10 minutes ago, off to interview someone, I dare say. Never mind about them. Our job's here, helping to keep this lab working smoothly." It was as close as Inspector Blakelock ever got to a rebuke. Brenda hurried to Miss Foley's office. It was known that the director didn't like people to knock on his door, so Brenda entered with what confidence she could muster. She thought, "I can only do my best. If that's not good enough, he'll have to lump it." He was sitting at the desk, apparently studying a file. He looked up without smiling in response to her good morning, and said, "Inspector Blakelock has explained to you that I want some help this morning. While Miss Foley's away, you can work with Mrs. Mallett in the general office." "Yes, sir." "The police will be needing some more files. They're interested in particular numbers only, but I expect Inspector Blakelock has explained that." "Yes, sir." "They're working on the 1976 and 75 registrations now, so you'd better start getting out the 1974 series and any earlier years they want." He took his eyes from the files and looked directly at her for the first time. "Dr. Lorimer left you some money, didn't he?" "Yes, sir. £1,000 for books and apparatus." "You don't need to call me sir. Dr. Howarth will do." "You liked him?" "Yes."
Yes, I did. Dr. Howarth had lowered his eyes again and was turning over the pages of the file. Odd. I shouldn't have thought that he would have appealed to women, or women to him. Brenda said resolutely, It wasn't like that. What wasn't it like? Do you mean he didn't think of you as a woman? I don't know. I mean, I didn't think he was trying to... Her voice broke off. Dr. Howarth turned a page. He said, To seduce you? Brenda took courage, helped by a spurt of anger. She said, Well, he couldn't, could he? Not here in the lab. And I never saw him anywhere else. And if you'd known anything about him at all, you wouldn't talk like that. She was appalled at her own temerity. But the director only said, rather sadly, she thought, I expect you're right. I never knew him at all. She struggled to explain. He explained to me what science is about. And what is science about? He explained that scientists formulate theories about how the physical world works, and then test them out by experiments. As long as the experiments succeed, then the theories hold. If they fail, the scientists have to find another theory to explain the facts. He says that with science, there's this exciting paradox that disillusionment needn't be defeat. It's a step forward. Didn't you do science at school? I thought you'd taken physics and chemistry at A-level. No one ever explained it like that before. No. I suppose they bored you with experiments about magnetism and the properties of carbon dioxide. By the way, Miss Furley has typed a paper on the ratio of staffing to workloads. I want the figures checked. Mrs. Mallett will do it with you. And the paper circulated to all directors before next week's meeting. She'll give you the list of addresses. Yes, sir. Yes, Dr. Howarth. And I'd like you to take this file to Miss Easterbrook in the biology lab. He looked up at her, and she thought for the first time that he looked kind. He said very gently, I know how you feel. I feel the same. But there's only a white outline on the floor, just a smudge of chalk. That's all. He handed her the file. It was a dismissal. At the door, Brenda paused. The director said, Well? I was just thinking that detection must be like science. The detective formulates a theory, then tests it. If the facts he discovers fit, then the theory holds. If they don't, then he has to find another theory, another suspect. Dr. Howarth said dryly, It's a reasonable analogy, but the temptation to select the right facts is probably greater. And the detective is experimenting with human beings. Their properties are complex and not susceptible to accurate analysis. An hour later, Brenda took her third set of files into Sergeant Underhill in the director's office. The pleasant-looking detective constable leaped forward to relieve her of her burden. The telephone rang on Dr. Howarth's desk, and Sergeant Underhill went over to answer it. He replaced the receiver and looked across at his companion. That's the Met Lab. They've given me the result of the blood analysis. The mallet was the weapon, all right. There's Lorimer's blood on it. And they've analysed the vomit. He looked up, suddenly remembering that Brenda was still in the room, and waited until she had left and the door was closed. The detective constable said, Well? It's what we thought. Think it out for yourself. A forensic scientist would know that the lab can't determine a blood group from vomit. The stomach acids destroy the antibodies. What they can hope to say is what was in the food. So all you need to do, if it's your vomit and you're a suspect, is to lie about what you ate for supper. Who could disprove it? His companion said, Unless... Sergeant Underhill reached again for the phone. Exactly. As I said, think it out for yourself.
This ends Disc 7.